If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
The women's narrative we would like to think of is that, you know, if we let women rule the world, it would be a much nicer place. But, you know, the truth is subtle and nuanced and complex.
That was Max Adams talking about women through history.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today's interview is with the historian and author Max Adams, whose latest book highlights the stories of some of history's most remarkable forgotten women. He met up with our digital editorial assistant, Rachel Dinning, at the Yorkshire Museum in York, ahead of his talk at our History Weekend event there last year. Here's how the conversation went.
So I'm at our annual York History Weekend with archaeologist and writer Max Adams. So Max has recently published a book called Unquiet Women, a collection of stories about remarkable women in history from the dusk of the Roman Empire to the dawn of the Enlightenment. So welcome, Max. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, we'll start with your book. Why did you want to write a book about women?
Well, when you read the introduction, you'll see that I come from a family of very, very strong women who've influenced me probably more ways than I know. My mother was one of 14, and I have a large tribe of very, very self-confident and interesting aunts. So that's in my background. But I'm often being taxed by readers and students with the fact that there aren't many women in the periods of history that I deal with. And I keep having to say, well, actually, those women are there. They're a little trickier to write into the big narrative, but they're there. And eventually I realised that I just was making an excuse for not writing something about women. And I thought I owed it to my family and to myself and to readers to actually go and put the effort in. And I'd been collecting stories about women for ages, and I'd given a course, a lifelong learning course called Seven Women, years ago. So I thought, right, now's the time. I will write this book, and I will find the stories. There's only one criterion for getting in this book, and it's that they interest me. And I trust that readers will be interested by the women in history who interest me. Hope so.
Great. And you focus on stories from the end of the Roman Empire to the dawn of the Enlightenment. And that's quite a broad span. Yeah. Was there a reason for this particular time period? Or is it just a coincidence that the women you chose?
Well, the period I know best is the early medieval anyway. And it struck me, a lot of women in the classical world are quite well known, whether it's empresses or poets. And it struck me that the arrival of Christianity in the West after the in the late Roman period heralds slightly more liberating, not role for women, but in having their voices heard, because Christianity offered women an equal place in heaven. And, you know, one of the two or three great Christian icons is the Virgin Mary. And in a sense, she represents the mother of everybody. So she empowered women to believe that they had a place in this new Christian world, including the afterlife, probably to compensate for the stuff that they had to put up with in their real lives. So that was a good starting point. And increasingly, of course, we begin to learn about women who were holy women and saints. And my suspicion has always been that those holy women would have been holy women in the pre-Christian period. These are cunning women and healers and midwives, women with aptitude and skill and intelligence whose stories otherwise aren't heard. And then going forward, it struck me that in about 1700, the trajectory of women's history changes for all sorts of quite complicated reasons. But the main one for me really is that infant mortality starts to decline drastically in the West. And that is a form of liberation for women in any case. I mean, my mother was one of 14. My grandmother, Constance Alexandra Corinna, bore 14 children. Childbearing and child rearing is not only incredibly dangerous, but it takes up your life, mm-hmm. creatively and artistically. So it seemed a good bookend for a period in which the sorts of women I'm interested in shared experiences with each other, I think. So there was a common thread that runs through all these stories.
I mean, it's often said that mainstream history is dominated by men and by men's narratives. And one argument for the lack of focus on women's stories is that, well, no one was bothering to write their stories down, so we just maybe don't have the evidence there to create a history for women. I mean, is that fair to say?
In one sense, it is. The written narrative is overwhelmingly male, written and dominated by. However, first of all, as an archaeologist, I know that in death, women become as visible as men. We excavate as many women as we do men. So that is an equality of a sort. And many years ago, I excavated the crypt at Spitalfields, which is one of the bookends for this book. And in Spitalfields, there are 52-53% women. So their narratives in death are equally present with men. So that's one thing to say. In archaeology, women are much more visible than men. Although the written word is overwhelmingly a male narrative, there is another set of narratives going on which are produced by female agency and authorship. And once you realise there's another narrative going on, you can begin to see how you might read it. And you want to know what that is, don't you?
I do. You knew exactly what I was going to say next.
It's textiles. Through most societies, women have been the textile producers, whether it's wool or cotton or flax or whatever, and to a very high level of sophistication. Two problems arise with the textile narrative. One is that it doesn't carry the same sort of narrative as writing. The other is that textiles are very vulnerable to decay. The oak gall link of the Lindisfarne Gospel has survived 1,500 years effortlessly. And of course, men are designing the technology to make their words permanent. Textiles don't preserve very well, except in certain circumstances. So that's a big problem. How do you get at that narrative when the textiles have largely gone? That is a problem. But if you start looking, those narratives emerge. And in fact, almost all the stories in this book have some connection with textiles, one way or the other. It's really amazing how it just comes out time and time again, even when that's not what you're looking for.
Can you give us maybe an example of one of the women in the book whose story can be explained via textiles?
Well, one of the stories that struck me most forcibly, and it runs counter to the idea that women's voices aren't heard. We know of a woman called Winflad who made a will in the 10th century. She's an Anglo-Saxon woman. Now, she's a wealthy woman. And even though we can say that, generally speaking, women have been oppressed by men, elite women were always better off than poor men. This woman, Winflad, wrote a will in about the year 950, and we have it. And it's an incredible document. It tells us about who was important to her. It tells us what things were important to her. It tells us about how she saw herself in the world and in the afterlife. So, first of all, she has huge estates, and she leaves these first to her daughter. Well, that's interesting.
Did she have a son?
She does have a son.
Oh, interesting.
And he does get stuff, but the bulk of the estate goes to her daughter, right? So this idea that women were not independent property owners is simply not true, especially when you think of widowhood. A lot of men are dying younger than women in battle or from the physical drudgery of their work. And women widows can accumulate property. And a lot of women have been widowed more than once. In fact, some women make a business out of it. Okay, that's a whole different narrative. So the things Winflad leaves, she has a whole load of slaves. So, okay, the women's narrative we would like to think of is that, you know, if we let women rule the world, it would be a much nicer place. But, you know, the truth is subtle and nuanced and complex. These very rich women own slaves. Of course they do. They're Christian women, they own slaves. That doesn't contradict morally for them. However, because she's a Christian, on her death, it's a good thing for her soul to release her slaves, to give them freedom. And she gives most of her slaves freedom, but there are two slaves who she does not free on her death, and they're really, really interesting. One is her sewing mistress, and the other is her weaving mistress, right? These are the women who know the family textile narrative. They know the way that that family designs, weaves, and decorates textiles.
So it's their brand in a weird way.
They know the brand, and they are bequeathed to her daughter, so that that linear agency and authorship is passed down through the female line. Well, that's very interesting for a kickoff. Then, of course, we read about the things she leaves behind: her sewing kit, her weaving kit, her double badger-skinned gown.
A badger-skinned gown,
if
yeah.
That's what it is, I'm not entirely sure it is. I think it might be something else. But her tent.
A tent? I mean, what would she have used a tent for? Red tent as well.
It's a red tent, quite, so there's maybe a narrative in there. Well, elite people travel around all the time. They have to go and collect the food from where it's produced so they can consume the surplus of the land. And they're always travelling. They're travelling to court. They're travelling to meet people. You know, they move around the landscape. And of course, we know very little about Anglo-Saxon tents. And to have this record of a red tent, and the colour especially, is interesting. So that's fascinating. And then we realise that her most important possession is her bed. Now, isn't that interesting? Because we don't really think of beds as bequeathable possessions. We think of them as rather utilitarian. But we know from all sorts of other things that the women buried in the Osberg ship in Norway were buried with a bed. In fact, I think they had several beds with them. These beds are beautifully ornate pieces of the finest workmanship. They're stunning things, decorated finials and terminals. We also know that in the 7th century, wealthy Anglo-Saxon women are being buried in their beds. Now, why is that? Well, we don't know, but it's clearly an important part of a woman's narrative that bed goes with her. So there are these stories about women's agency that are there. Mm-hmm. You can see why they're not getting into the mainstream narratives, but nevertheless, they are there, and they seem to keep connecting with each other. And if we had more textiles surviving, we would get a better story. In South America, we do have the textiles, and there the story is much stronger.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's dry.
Purely down to the weather. Curse this British weather again for a British history.
There is one instance in which textiles do survive. We don't get much patterning in medieval textiles, but most Christians, if they're not buried with their possessions, they're usually buried in their clothes, sometimes with jewellery, or their knives, or their chatelaines. And women are buried with the chatelaines that hold the keys to their household.
Sorry, what's a
chatelaine? It's a little sort of belt fitting from which you hang set of keys and tweezers and so on. And this is a woman's status as the head of a household, because we forget that the house is the map of women's social geography. Mm-hmm. And we've got interesting accounts of how houses are designed so that women can control the space in them.
It's the women's field,
their battlefield. There's a whole area of narrative and story there. It's not written about very much because it seems mundane. It's not stories of kings and queens, but it's much more interesting than kings and queens, I think. Anyway, when people are buried with metalwork, as the body decays, the clothes that they're in rot, and the corrosion of the metalwork absorbs the pattern of the textile into it. So if you look on the back of this metalwork when it's retrieved by archaeologists, it may not have the colours anymore, but we can tell what type of fabric it is. We can tell what weave count it is. We can tell if it's a twill or a broken twill or a diamond twill. Mm-hmm. So the technology of weaving, we have quite a lot of information about. In fact, we know a great deal about the technology of weaving. If we then suppose that that's the women's narrative, that means we've got a lot of things we can say about how women are using their space and their time and their craft to develop really quite sophisticated stuff. What we don't get is the really crucial bit. And that is that imagine pretty much any item of clothing is going to have a decorated cuff and a neck and a hem. Those are the absolutely key things. And those things are woven on a tablet, which is a set of small square cards with holes in them. And the yarn is threaded through them. You tie one end to the back of a seat, a chair or something, and you turn the cards over to create... It's basic digital computing. It's a digital patterning. It's an early knitting machine. And these patterns are very geometrical because they're made on a grid. And every now and then you have to undo the tension. So you unweave them and you get a reverse pattern.
Right, okay.
Okay, so that's interesting. We do have some of these things, not nearly enough. Now, my contention... hard to prove, is that this is where the brand is. It's Winfled's family, that's one of theirs.
And this is what she wanted to preserve by passing down her seamstress and...
I think so. I think that's right. And we know that women are not just clothing themselves, they're clothing their menfolk. So their menfolk who go to court or who are presented to their lord or fight in battle are wearing their colours, literally, okay? And when these things are given as presents, that is a way of negotiating social power networks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that narrative is there. We can't have much access to it, but we must accept that that is there, that although we've lost it, it is there. There is women's agency. So, for example, there's a pair of embroidered slippers by a holy woman in the 13th century. That ends up as a gift to the Pope. Now, that's agency and power.
Yeah.
From woman's narrative and authorship and craft. And I think we underestimate that agency.
We'll come back to this agency later on, because I want to explore that in detail.
Yeah.
Just quickly, though, before we go on to that, I wanted to ask you about women's history in general. Because women's history today is like, it's its own topic. You know, at university, you can choose modules, you can choose to study women's history in bookshops. They might have a women's history section. Hmm. On our website, we've got a women's history tab. Obviously, we don't have a men's history tab. But, I mean, just the history is the men's history. Do you think that we're going to get to a stage where we won't need to have this distinct category? Do you think it's possible to get to that stage?
Well, I'd like to think that men can write about women and women can write about men. God, I hope so. I don't know. I mean, I think it's absolutely vital that the balance is redressed. And if that means we have to have I say we have to have, we have university courses and PhDs in not just women's history, but gender studies in general, which I would separate out. I would say that women's history and gender studies are not quite the same thing. I would militantly defend the right of anybody to write about anything that they thought needed to be written about. And I absolutely would defend any woman's right to write her a story about men. And I don't think I need to defend myself.
Have you wondered, are people going to be like, oh, you're a man writing women's stories? Is that...
I'm a historian writing about history.
Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, it's a book written by a man about women. But then I was like, actually, it'd be quite nice if more men wrote stories about women.
Well...
And I'll tell you why I thought this as well, because when I was doing my A-levels, we had the first module we did was suffragettes, and lots of people chose history for A-level. And so we did suffragettes, and then what we were going to do after the suffragettes was World War II from Germany's perspective. Mm. Lots of the guys that are my classmates dropped out of history. They dropped it as a subject because they found... the suffragettes. So we were given 6 weeks to decide if we wanted to carry on doing the course, and quite a number dropped out, and they said, oh, well, it's boring. And they didn't even, they were like, oh, I want to do the Germany bit, but this bit's boring. And I was just like, that's so, so sad. And I just feel if more men and boys could feel a bit more engaged with women's history, that that would help. But that's just my personal opinion.
I completely agree. And I think sometimes the way we're taught history is quite partisan. I don't think women should own the suffragette narrative any more than that men should own any of their narratives. I mean, ultimately, the stories that I've found are stories available to anybody who bothered to look, male or female, young or old, of any race or background. The stories are written there. I mean, the archaeologist has slightly more specialised access, many, many women archaeologists. And those stories are available to be written. The only thing I really care about is that I'm not interesting and they are. So if the narrative becomes, why is a man writing about women's history, I think that would be a problem for me.
Yeah.
Because I'm not interesting.
I'm sure that's not true, but of writing the book, it's all their voices.
Yeah, quite. So, I think it's an interesting subject for debate. But I think you're right. I wish a lot more men would write a lot more about women in history, whether that's women's history.
It's a distinction there, isn't there?
I think there probably is a distinction, yeah. And I also think, I had to, of course, you do a lot of reading for these things, and quite a lot of these stories have been first written down by men. Some are women's own stories, they've written them, and some are stories that appear in narratives that are not very accessible because they come out of a fairly narrowly constrained academic idea of gender theory. And that's how those stories have been brought back out by, you know, women writers and thinkers fighting to have those stories written. I'm the beneficiary of that work. And what I can do is bring those narratives to a broader public, acknowledging the work of the people who've done the really hard work, the translators, the people who found out these sources. I mean, there's an 18th century Peruvian woman called Ana de la Calle. She actually has four names in the narrative. She changes her name and that of her children. She's also a slave owner, but she's also a freed slave. And we have her will. And it's a very, very interesting document. She too is interested in her bed linen and where these things go to. And she makes a fascinating pair with Winfled, the Anglo-Saxon woman. Several, you know, almost 1,000 years apart, these two women, 800 years apart. The things that make those women interesting keep coming up in narratives. And the more you look at them from the point of view, supposing you could do that, of thinking about how women's stories are told, the more you realise that the evidence is out there and that you can construct it. So for me, it has been hugely liberating. And, you know, for the record, there is no way that anything I write after this will not be much, much more aware of the possibilities of writing women into the narrative. For me, it's been a huge lesson.
Yeah.
You have to go through that process of seeing those connections for yourself and going, oh, yeah, of course, that's how you can write about women. It's really easy to say,
a learning process,
we can't write about women because we don't have the...
We do.
It's not true. it requires a certain way of looking, a bit like looking at a map in a different way. Once you've got that perspective, for me as an author, I couldn't ever go back.
Do you feel like your eyes have been opened and now you can't sort of shut them?
Completely, yeah. And I've been talking to my oldest surviving aunt about this, because she's a weaver. Mm. And we've talked a lot about textiles and weaving. And of course, none of this was any surprise to her. And she kind of brought me up thinking about those things. But to think about them, to know they exist, is different from really understanding just what you can do with those apparently fairly slim lines of, if I write a book about the Arthurian period, which is my next project, there's no way that I can now write that without thinking how I can write a lot more about women. And I think that's a really healthy thing for me as a writer.
Yeah.
Wish I'd done it sooner.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Going back to this idea of women and agency.
Mm.
So we're sort of repeatedly told that women are the supporting characters through history. They were oppressed, they were exploited, they were uneducated.
Mm.
It sort of paints this picture of women as being these like meek victims through history, which isn't the case, as you described a few of these already. So perhaps you can tell us about instances of women, the ones in your book, where they're showing remarkable agency or exercising
it's
power.
It's true. I mean, I'm a reasonably sharp-eyed archaeologist, and even I've not been looking in the right places for this agency. Yeah, it is there. And I think it's actually really lazy for us to write the narrative that allows us to not write about women, because it's difficult to find the evidence there. There's a life, there are any number of medieval saints' lives, and they're very conventional. They tend to be pretty boring and quite difficult for a 20th century sceptical mind to digest. But some of them stand out precisely because there's agency in them. So there's a woman called Christina of Marquiate. She's not the most famous woman saint. Marjorie Kemp is in the book. She's much better known. Athelflaed, Lady of the Mercians, is in there. St. Hild is in there. Christina of Marquiate is something a little bit different, because it appears that if she didn't write her own story, she at least dictated it. It's got agency written all over it. And this is a story of brutality, of deprivation, of isolation, of prejudice. And through it all, this unquiet mind, this restlessly curious woman who will not put up with that, fights against it. And, you know, one of the lessons of these stories is that women are oppressed by women as well as men. Men are oppressed by men and women. Women are oppressed by men and women. The standard story that men oppress women is almost certainly true in a general sense. But every generation, there are women who will not put up with it. The women with wanderlust. So the first story in the book is this extraordinary woman called Egeria. We don't know where she's from, Atlantic France or Atlantic Spain. As the Roman Empire is collapsing about us, she sets off on a little holiday for 3 years to the Holy Land. And I've said in the book, you know, if they ever make the film about her, it's too late because she would, Catherine Hepburn would have to have played her part. It's unquestionably, this sort of rather waspish, I say young man, you know, what? be so good as to carry my bag sort of thing. I mean, very waspish sentiment, very matter of fact. A beautiful.
She was a nun, was she?
Well, she writes home to her blessed sisters. That sounds like she's in the community.
Like
she's a clearly devoted Christian. And she goes to see the place where Christ was martyred. And she visits the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. She's one of the earliest witnesses to the development of the whole business of Jerusalem as the centre of the Christian faith. She's a remarkable witness, very sharp-eyed, very matter-of-fact. She climbs Mount Sinai.
She travels, I think, over 3,000 miles.
At least.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And this is while the Roman Empire is supposedly collapsing.
Collapsing around her.
And the fact that most of this narrative survives, you know, there's a very strong woman's narrative. You know, she's in the line of the great travel writers.
Yeah.
You know, Celia Fiennes, who's also in the book, Freya Stark, who's later, lots and lots and lots of them. And people like Marjorie Kemp, who also went to Jerusalem and made a thorough nuisance of herself. But Christina Marquette's brilliant. I mean, her escape from bondage, stripped naked and beaten by her mother. That's an uncomfortable and shocking thing to read.
So just for our listeners, who was she?
Christina of Marquette. She's born in Huntingdonshire, if not Huntingdon. She arrives at a time when her parents are the first generation of people having to put up with the Normans. Mm-hmm. And they are a wealthy family and they have to integrate with the new patrons in the land. And they allow her to be seduced, if that is not too kind a word, by a bishop, which again is a quite shocking narrative. And she spurns him. She allows him into her room and then runs out and locks the door on him. I mean, it's a great yarn. It's a brilliant yarn. And then she's beaten by her family for doing that, ruining their reputation. And then she's sort of taken under the protection of a local hermit or holy man. And she escapes in the dead of night, you know, with a horse waiting and a cloak. It's all cloak and dagger. And she's treated to extraordinary brutality by many, many people and then lives in desperate isolation for a long time until her reputation as a visionary, which in, of course, earlier times she would have been a cunning woman, you know, a seer, a shamaness, and there are several shamanesses in this book. And they're, of course, an interesting set of women anyway. You know, when is a shamaness also a midwife? When is she a witch?
Crossover with medicine and superstition.
Oh, completely, yeah. That's another thing that comes very, very strongly through, that crossover between healing and prophesying and being visionary. And one thing that the hermit movement does allow is women to be visionary hermits as well. It's much harder for them than for men because they don't have independent wealth. But she's an example of someone who does it. And she ends her life a very famous woman.
Mm-hmm.
And her story deserves to be much better known than it is, especially as it seems to be largely her own story. And then, of course, we've got the Paston family in the 15th century they produce one of the great sets of letters,
yeah.
That's right. Much studied. But if you take some of the stories of the younger women, the stories that they haven't written themselves, being written in a series of letters by their angry parents, because these girls won't marry the men they're supposed to marry. They're either old or crippled or, you know, I mean, repulsive old, you know, Dickensian type stuff. Or they already have a lover. Or in one case, a woman undergoes an unofficial form of marriage with the family steward.
Oh, that must have been very controversial.
Massive scandal. And she's beaten to within an inch of her life by her mother. That's really hard for us to read.
Yeah.
Really hard to read.
Well, it's another example of women how women oppress, but can oppress women as well.
Yeah, and the surprises you get when you read stories from the past. And she enjoys a very uncomfortable relationship with her mother. Interestingly enough, she is sort of banished from the family and not allowed to inherit. The steward is kept on. She can be got rid of, but a steward is a too valuable man to get rid of. I mean, the hypocrisy.
With rage.
It's sort of middle-class English hypocrisy. I mean, yeah. It's absolutely infuriating. And, of course, one of the Paston girls is the author of the first Valentine letter, which we have. And that's a really beautiful thing because, as the end of the story says, you know, for all that middle-class snobbery and brutality, love sometimes did conquer all. And that's nice to be able to write about that too.
It's nice that that's something that continues over through history. We've talked a bit about how history is often dominated by men and male narratives, but I think it's also probably fair to say that history is dominated by white or Western narratives as well. Perhaps you can tell us about some of the remarkable women who feature in your book who are not Western.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to spend another few years looking for stories that were hard. I mean, Muslim women are really hard to find stories about. I mean, there are lots of them in the narratives, but they're written about in a very patriarchal way, which is quite difficult to chew. There are one or two Muslim women in there, including a rather wonderful bisexual 10th century poetess from Cordoba, who, when tried for harlotry, she was had very open affairs with both men and women. She attended the trial wearing a textile, a gown, into which had been woven. This is an Arabic, an Arabic style of craftsmanship. Wearing a gown into which were woven the words, I can't remember it now, but it basically says, "I will kiss whom I please, and I am my own person, and I will go my own way. I'll do what I want." And you think, wow, that's great. I'd love to have written more about women from Southeast Asia, but I've written a short piece about the only Chinese emperor was a woman, whether you call her an empress or an emperor. She's a rather interesting woman. Strangely enough, I wasn't expecting to find so many interesting stories in South America, but I found a lot in Central America, Southwestern United States, and South and Central America. Partly because the textiles survive, partly because stories survive about women that you wouldn't expect to. And the most exciting thing I found is a picture of a ceramic in northwest Peru, in the sort of old Inca, but pre-Inca territories. There was a style of pottery which was called a stirrup cup. And it's a globular pot that's made in two halves in a mould, so it can be reproduced. It's a commercial product. And the range of designs is really quite extraordinary. So so these are anthropomorphic sculptures in ceramic. You've got sex, not just sex, but every conceivable position. And you think, that's not just about fertility, because quite a few of those forms of sex are not reproductive. Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. You know, who's making those for whom and why? But there's a series of designs, and there are quite a few of them, which are cups. So they're stirrup cups. So they have two tubes that go into one. The idea is that as you're drinking out of it or pouring it, air comes in through the other one. So it's technically very advanced pottery, way ahead of anything we're doing in Europe at the time. This is 7th century, 6th, 7th century. There's a series of designs that depict childbirth. Okay, they're always a seated woman in the act of childbirth. Okay, so you see the full thing. There's a woman behind holding on for dear life.
Yeah.
Okay, they're in a sitting position. They're sometimes naked. They're sometimes got tunics on. The woman behind is kind of both embracing and shoving at the same time. And usually in front, and this is all part of the same piece of pottery, there's a midwife. I mean, I can only describe her as being in a sort of slip-catching position.
Yeah.
Like in cricket. And there's the baby's head emerging. And you think, well, who are you making this for? Because if you're making that for a pregnant woman, it slightly leaves
might
you a hostage.
Might put you off a little bit.
Slightly leaves you a hostage to fortune. Is it the midwife's calling card? Does the vessel contain some special unguent or oil or drug that's helping the birthing process? Is it advertising midwife? Who knows? We will never find out. But that is just such an extraordinary piece of art.
It's really nice to hear about women expressing their sexuality and expressing these real what it means to be a woman. Because I think it's we have a danger of thinking of women in the past I think it may be the Victorian period has some responsibility for this, everything being so prude and sexually repressed, but it's just nice to hear about that.
It is, and I think you're absolutely right that the Victorians have got a lot to answer for. They were, most of the narratives our generations grew up with were written initially by Victorians, and I think we have to scrape off the dark varnish of Victoriana and get back to... I mean, I've written before about women in the 18th, 19th centuries. You know, the first person ever called a scientist was a woman. The person who wrote all the infant custody laws to liberate women from male oppression in the 19th century, Caroline Norton, a woman. Who's ever heard of Caroline Norton? Some people have, but not many people. Which is why I say that in the 18th, 19th centuries, there's a rather different trajectory. There are many, many more women visible and writing. The book isn't the length it is, about 240 pages, 50 stories in it. There are not just 50 stories in there because I could only find 50 stories. I could have quadrupled that number of stories very, very easily.
Of course, sure, yeah.
And I've selected them carefully because I think the stories speak to each other as well as having individual interest, but the stories are out there. Mm-hmm. And I think all historians of all hues and aptitudes, and I speak, you know, especially for myself, have a duty to keep their ears tuned a bit more finely. I mean, that, for me, that's the way I describe it. You have to tune your ear a bit more finely to those stories and not just allow yourself to be lazy in accepting this idea that women don't have agency, they don't have a voice, they're either nuns or queens or invisible. It's just not true. And I wish people would get over obsessing about queens. I mean,
I feel really bad because I'm actually wearing a t-shirt right now with Queen Elizabeth on.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it is obsessive.
We did our top 100 women vote poll, and I mean, a lot of the women who were in this, although actually, no, Queen Elizabeth wasn't even in our top 100 women. Maybe that's a step in the right direction then.
Well, yeah, maybe. But I think we should stop obsessing about queens because apart from anything, there's a brilliant Geordie philosopher in the late 17th, early 18th century called Mary Astell. Again, not many people know about her, but she was brilliant. She wrote a tract, an anti-marriage tract, called A Serious Proposal to the Ladies. It's a fabulous piece of...
I think I've read this.
She was a brilliant writer. And she came up with this thing that I call the petticoat fallacy. Can I just read it to you? Because it's the frontispiece of the book.
Yes.
Because I used it because it... I aim it ironically at myself, of course. She says this. This is from a book called The Christian Religion in 1705. Since the men being the historians, they seldom condescend to record the great and good actions of women. And when they take notice of them, 'tis with this wise remark, that such women acted above their sex, by which one must suppose that they would have their readers understand that they were not women who did those great actions, but that they were men in petticoats. Wow. The obsession with queens is suffering from the petticoat fallacy. And from now on, for me, that's the petticoat fallacy. And nobody could ever have put it better than Mary Astell. It's a brilliant piece of writing. I love it so much. And, of course, as the frontispiece, I aim it squarely at myself. So there you go, humble pie. But it's great.
On that note, just looking at the time, I think we've got to wrap up for today.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for coming on our podcast. That's been an absolute pleasure.
Great. Thank you.
That was Max Adams. Unquiet Women, From the Dusk of the Roman Empire to the Dawn of the Enlightenment, is out now, published by Head of Zeus. And look out for a review of the book in the February issue of BBC History magazine, which goes on sale later this month. Meanwhile, our January edition is currently on sale and includes articles on the Treaty of Versailles, Mary Queen of Scots, the World War II battle for Norway, and the history behind the film The Favourite. Look out for it now in all good retailers and our many digital formats. And as I mentioned earlier, this talk was recorded at our History Weekend event in York. You can now book tickets for our next event, which is a Kings and Queens themed weekend that takes place in Oxford on the 2nd and 3rd of March. Find out more details and book tickets at historyextra.com/events. And that is all for today, but we will return on Thursday with more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast. which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.